Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
As a rule, I am not a huge fan of serial killer movies. I respect Silence of the Lambs and Fincher 7 as extremely well-crafted yet problematic films with stellar performances, but both of them kind of leave me cold because they seem to be a bit more obsessed with the pageantry of the genre,
yes,
the horror of it, and even though we do follow detectives, the emphasis is on the killer in a way that doesn't intrigue me very much. I really prefer movies about the pursuit of such a killer and what it does to the dogged detective. So beyond like Gwyneth Paltrow's Head in a Box, the darkness that William Peterson has to embrace that causes PTSD in Manhunter, for example, that's fascinating to me. Or what we see in Zodiac. This interests me very much. I actually, though, did not see this film right away because I was so worried it would play like a sequel to Seven. I mean, not literally, but kind of because I remember the horror of going to Seven with my brother and his friends and just leaving it. I don't think I slept for like three nights. It was just too much. It was so funny, though, what my first experience with the movie was like because I started the film. And then I realized when they started showing the years and the places that it was set, that my mom actually lived in that area around that time and drove around at night listening to music and hanging out. And so I'm watching this and I'm like, how am I gonna sell her on watching a serial killer movie? And so I watched a little more to make sure she could like handle it. And then she came home and I like hyped it up. Like, we're gonna watch this, and if it gets too much, like, whatever. And she was getting more and more freaked out when she was, you know, years were going by, and she's yes. like, yeah, I was there for part of that time, like the early 70s. And so that really creeped her out. But yeah, there's all kinds of weird touchstones in the movie. Like my Uncle Gary, who I've told you about, he's passed on now, a vice police officer in Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And his thing used to be getting animal crackers. I don't know if it was from Bullet or where it came from, but he worked the night shift and would get animal crackers. So I'm watching Dave Toski, Mark Ruffalo do this and thinking about Gary. And the funniest story with him and animal crackers was he actually went to a gas station in the middle of a shift, walked in, and while he was getting his animal crackers, it was robbed. And so he had to like step in. And he's like, man, I just want my animal crackers. But yeah, so I don't know. So this movie had some interesting links that way for me as well.
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle, a 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac. Adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by the screenwriter James Vanderbilt, the film of course stars an incredible ensemble cast led by Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Our introduction today was film critic and host of the terrific and insightful Watch with Jen podcast, my friend, Jen Johans. Before we dive into the theme of the week and the show proper, I'd love to remind you to jump on and rate and review the show wherever you're listening. It's a huge help to find even more of those lovers of our brand of obsessive cinematic deep dives. I also want to let you know that links to our Patreon with our weekly Rum and Rant podcast and special Uncut Zodiac Sessions interviews, the latest one with Liz Hannah, as well as links to our merchandise with artwork by the incredible Brianna Ashby and Amy Reid are in the show description or at oneheatminute.com. Joining me today to tirelessly work through fake confessions and misdirections to find a guy whose favorite book is The Most Dangerous Game. Ah, writer and contributor for Film School Rejects and Paste, Brianna Ziegler.
That's another scene where if you watch the movie multiple times, it's where you hope it's going to end differently. But like it always starts off and I'm like, they got this. They're being reasonable. Like he gives them the keys. It's going to be good. And then I have that thought of like, it doesn't matter because the point is to kill them. It's not to get their money. It doesn't matter that they're both humans. It's just about the bloodlust. And it's almost like a fuck you to the audience for like finding that first scene so fun.
Yes.
You know, it's like it comes back around with another couple and this time it's like, yeah, no, this is fucked up. Like really fucked up.
Yes.
Not fun fucked up.
Not fun fucked up.
Former film critic at the LA Weekly and Village Voice, former host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, now filmmaker and screenwriter of Blumhouse's Black Christmas, April Wolfe.
If you look at Seven or The Game or anything else, you know, like they all have their own very different, interesting thing. And, you know, he's able to make, for instance, in The Game, he's able to make San Francisco seem desolate.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, in this film, it's a busy, populated city. And he has the control with that sound and I think recognizes that he has that. And I just, I mean, again, it's that novelistic approach of thinking about filmmaking in this way where you need to have control of every detail.
And returning, award-winning screenwriter and auteurist podcasting mastermind, Lee Zachariah, editor at large at RogerEbert.com, TV critic at Vulture, Matt Zolozides, film critic on sabbatical with bylines at RogerEbert.com and the Metaplex, Brendan Hodges, online movie writing veteran, Moriarty at Ain't It Cool, the founder of HitFix, film critic, screenwriter, industry analyst, the legendary Drew McWeeny, writer, film and book critic, Bill Ryan, film critic and editor at large of Empire Magazine, co-host of the ginormous Empire podcast and author of the newly released and terrific Woman vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, Helen O'Hara, editor-in-chief of Fangoria, executive producer, Horror Noir, and Shudder's upcoming queer horror documentary, Phil Nobile Jr., and finally, award-winning actor on stage and screen, a man who delivers the most consistently involving and affecting characters to a myriad of films and TV, including Fargo, The Trial of the Chicago 7, Gothica, The Drew Carey Show, Shutter Island, The Invitation, The Founder, and this film, Zodiac. Just a little aperitif before perhaps the scene of the film, the incredible John Carroll Lynch. This is the 13th episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Cancer Part 1. In this episode, after a news call out for more information, the second flood of Zodiac-obsessed crazies and paranoid people enveloped the San Francisco PD. After Avery essentially embarrasses them live on air by connecting the dots to another potential Z-killing, Armstrong and Toski are forced to wade through every single fake confession, slanderous and false accusation from the wild and wonderfully weird inhabitants of 70 San Francisco. Going through the motions, following up every lead, eventually leads to an interview that jolts Armstrong awake. The Most Dangerous Game, a light at the end of the gun. This could be our guy. Every episode we used a film title to encapsulate our theme. That insatiable suspicion that a case like this inspires. The viral distrust that makes you think twice about everyone around you. So as we're stuck in the Zodiac quagmire, giving side eye to anyone of our neighbours, family or friends that we could imagine has the urge to kill or terrorise, I thought the theme for today's episode should be another film dripping with paranoia and set in San Francisco. Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Thank you.
Let's get to the scene. We left off after an altogether frustrating encounter at the Riverside PD, handwriting samples, communication with police and media. The most legitimate suspect for Donal Logue's Nalo, Ruffalo's Dave Toski, and Zach Grenier's Mel Nicolai. Yet, John Marn's stubborn and old-school Riverside captain likes another guy and thinks that cooperating is sharing information with the Chronicle. Bridging the added insult of Nalo saying,
"Well, there's your press agent. Talk to him about it."
To the injury of having their pants pulled down on television and the latest wave of sicko fans, Fincher selects a loop from a track from a landmark soul album, 1969's Hot Buttered Soul by Isaac Hayes. The song,
hyperbolic syllabic, sesquidanous,
the mesmerizing rhythm of the bass riff and the punctuative guitar flange give rhythm and soul to the soul-sucking encounters with bad actors looking for a fast track to infamy, or those so incredibly fearful that the world is filled with Zodiacs. Here's Phil Nobile Jr. on a fact that I think is very pertinent to this case and this town and the state of Western civilization for about the last 40 years. People are unwell.
Yeah, I mean, a quick guess to that would be that we are severely underserving the mentally ill in my country. And, you know, this is someone that should be either medicated or in therapy or supervised. And, you know, our streets are lousy with homeless folks who are, you know, aren't just, you know, down on their luck. These are mentally ill people that aren't getting treatment. And I think there's very much grades of that. And you know, any sales job I've ever had, or any, you know, where I've ever had to call strangers, you wouldn't get to the end of the day before you get a random person on the other end of the line who's just not well. And you know, I think that it's all different shades of that. And in a city, like San Francisco, where there's a lot of fringe dweller sounds derogatory, and I don't mean it that way, but people that aren't, you know, middle of the road meat and potatoes, you know, Americans, there's a lot of young people, there's a lot of substances in San Francisco back then. I think the city, like the Tenderloin district and all that, it just attracted probably a higher than average quotient of mentally ill folks. And so that's why you have a police department full of people saying they're the Zodiac, or the Zodiac's their neighbor. The other thing that I think is so amazing about the movie, and so, which so like is such a smoking gun about it being a post 9/11 thing, is that he even stops the letters fairly early.
Yeah.
Like the bulk of this movie is just people spinning out from this fairly concentrated campaign, right?
Yes.
And I think that, you know, what you just said about xenophobia and mistrusting, you know, Middle Eastern folks and brown folks in your community, I think we're still feeling that from 9/11.
Yeah.
It just keeps going, and we'll be years undoing all of it.
You should have called me, Paul.
Yep.
So the scene starts with a clipping, ever so delicately being extracted from the paper. We see the face of Jake Gyllenhaal's Robert Graysmith in a particularly down moment. Gone is his kind of puppy dog buoyancy bouncing around the newsroom. For the first time that we've seen in the film so far, the deadening sensation of new questions without answers is finally registering on his face. Here's Lee Zachariah on a theory that he has about the merging of this serial killer energy and of Graysmith.
It's not about the Zodiac Killer. This film isn't about the Zodiac Killer. This film is about what it's like to be a psychopath.
Yeah.
And we spend the whole film following one. And there are so many clues, and he misses all of them. All people do day after day is tell him that he's an outsider. He's a psychopath. It's just his energies got channeled into something different. They got channeled into raising a family. And just to be clear, I'm talking about the movie Robert Graysmith. Don't know the man. I did read that, you know, he read the script and went, oh, that's why my wife divorced me. I get it now. So there's got to be an element of truth to it. But, you know, this is a man who gets told, you know, almost the first time we see him, everyone said, you know, was it Paul Avery says, everybody, let's go to Morty's. And we see him looking outside, standing outside, looking in the door. He's an outsider. That is such a quick scene. That's a lot of setup for two very quick shots. And the purpose of those shots is to establish him as an outsider. How does he know that the Zodiac wouldn't give his name? He's asked and he doesn't answer. Because I think deep down he knows the answer is something he doesn't want to admit. He's, you know, you think about the thing that people call him behind his back. There's just clue after clue. When he's in the prison, there is just, we just keep getting told over and over again that there is something wrong with Robert Graysmith, that he is an outsider, that he doesn't quite fit into society. And this search that he is undergoing is a search for himself, ultimately. That's who he wants to look in the eye. That's who he wants to understand. And it's all there but for the grace of God, go I. You know, a slight twist of fate. And it's Robert Graysmith killing people. That's the message of the film. That is what it's telling us. You think there's a thin line between crime and order. There is a thin line between us, between the paths that we can take. You know, crime and order are just arbitrary, you know, categories for the places that we end up, the things we end up doing based on the circumstance in our life. And that's what this film was to me on the last viewing, is realizing that from word go, you know who the Zodiac is. You know the guy that you're looking for. You see him from the beginning. And it's not the guy out there killing people. He's incidental. He's just pushing the characters to do what they do. That's not who we're looking for. Yeah, look at the scene when he first reads out the message and the way he does it. He reads it robotically, like a serial killer would. It's so hot, like it's almost too much.
Yeah,
he's almost over exit beyond, you know, recognition. But he sounds like a serial killer, even though he's reading the words of a serial killer. He does it in a way that kind of makes it feel like he is.
Did you see this?
Unfortunately, yes.
Here comes every lunatic in California.
I'm the Zodiac.
And how did you kill your victims?
With a gun? No. With a hammer.
All I'm authorized to tell you is that he's still under government employment.
And who authorized you to tell me this?
That's all I'm authorized to say.
Only a little rat bastard like Andre could have done something like cut off all the victims' hands.
Zodiac didn't cut off any of the victims' hands.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir.
Travis and I work here side by side for 10 years. His foot gets crushed in an accident and the killings begin. Coincidence?
I don't know.
You're a cop, man. Do the math.
Have you considered the killer might be Paul Avery?
Frequently.
He was drinking Coors, getting a load.
Here's
off.
Drew McWeeny on the avalanche of facts in Zodiac and another connection to another conspiratorial thriller.
I think one of the other films that kind of comes to mind that tries to do this, and I love this movie, but I ultimately think the director got lost in the notion of, I need to have a character find a conclusion or come to a conclusion and have an answer because the audience is going to need that from me.
Yes.
I think Oliver Stone's JFK,
yes,
is a terrific piece about obsession and about getting lost in the avalanche of facts and getting lost in the
Absolutely.
Idea that you're trying to pull apart something that's essentially unknowable. You're never going to get that answer. But Garrison slowly goes insane. I think Oliver needed that courtroom scene where he gets to be Clarence Darrow, or he gets to be, you know, Atticus Finch, and he gets to kind of put the summation on it, make us feel better, and let us know, hey, there may be no answer to this, but I'm going to get answers, and answers are coming, and you're doing. He wants you to feel at the end of it good and satisfied. And I feel like it's the one place where Oliver cheats his own movie terribly, because that film should have the same kind of lingering, horrible, dissatisfying itch at the end of it, where Garrison didn't get.
No.
a conclusion to this. And Garrison was ruined by this. Garrison, his public image was ruined by this.
Absolutely.
So that to me is where somebody chickened out. They got right up to the finish line and then was like, but I'm going to have Kevin Costner play him and I'm not going to make him crazy.
Yeah, we can't make Kevin go completely batshit by the end of this
and
movie.
And Fincher's like, oh no, fuck that. One guy's an alcoholic. Another guy retires from the police force because he's broken and accused of doing something terrible. And the cartoonist just can't be a human being anymore. So
it took us giving him the script to figure out why he got divorced for this.
God. Amazing.
Now here's April Wolf on revisiting this film even more since transitioning from a film critic into a filmmaker and admiring the effortlessness of the transitions. And then we're going to make our own effortless transition to a little bit from Mr. John Carroll Lynch, star of this film, about his observations watching master filmmakers' stylistic control.
I came to Zodiac pretty late because I wasn't necessarily on the Fincher train. You know, I had loved Seven, and it wasn't like something that I was seeking out the rest of his work. You know, it would come to me and I'd be like, oh, that's great. But I would never kind of pull it together as a thread of like, this is Fincher. Now, of course, like later on in my life, I can sit back and look at this filmmaker and say that this is singularly a Fincher movie when I see one. But I was just kind of a casual enjoyer of them. And this movie, coming to it so late, I mean, I really only watched it for the first time about a year ago. And I think that's a great time for me to watch it just because kind of having transitioned fully into the filmmaking side of things after working criticism, I get to appreciate a little bit more about some of the things that he pulls off and some of these really small details that kind of make a Fincher movie a Fincher movie. And that I'm sitting there like taking notes on, you know. So I've seen it three times now just in the past year because, you know, I'll find it whenever it's streaming and I'll just be sitting there. And his transitions, while they are not groundbreaking, are so smooth and satisfying and visually detailed in both foreground and background. And that's something that so many people aren't looking at. They're not trying to be clever, and that's something that I really appreciate about his work in particular.
This is a grotesque example, so forgive me, but I've been to the Picasso Museum in Barcelona, and he's a student, child. Yeah. And its rooms are filled with form drawings. Excellent, excellent form drawings.
Yes.
You know, supple, muscular hands and arms and bodies. He was a master. If he wanted to, everything could have been a beautiful form drawing. He didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
He didn't care. Yeah. He was going for something else.
He was going for something
else. And that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
And when you work with master directors, all of them are going for something.
Yes.
And I've never worked with Soderbergh, but other master directors I've worked with are interested in individual things, whether it's a kinetic energy, whether it's a kind of control that we're talking about with David, you know, there are, and it all boils down to what their interests are.
Yes.
And it's amazing to me when I watch a movie from a director with an established set of interests, and they suddenly do a movie that has none of them.
Yeah.
Like David Lynch and Straight Story,
yeah,
or Todd Haynes and Dark Waters.
Yeah.
Those two movies should have been made by somebody else. And they just dropped absolutely all of what they do and did something else. And to be able to do that, to have that kind of control of storytelling, to learn to be like, it would be like Eric Clapton coming on stage and going, hey, everybody, I'm going to play the next 90 minutes like Carlos Santana. And then he does it. And you go, well, shit. You know, like, it's hard enough to play like Eric Clapton, and now you're going to play like Carlos Santana. Like, that's what, you know, those two directors that I'm pointing out did in those movies. They just...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
They just did a different movie because they can. I find that astounding.
There's not a more Alan Pakula movie that's ever been made that wasn't Alan Pakula than Dark Waters. Alan Pakula.
Yeah.
It was an angel on Todd Haynes' shoulder. That's the kind of movie that this is.
Yep. And it's, you know, there's no melodrama, there's no bright colors, there's no sense of kind of costume style, there's no moving cameras, there's no, you know.
But nonetheless, it is a pretty much staggering masterpiece of a movie.
Fantastic film. Fantastic film.
Such a good film.
Heartbreaking, just heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, David's mastery of all of it. From Soup to Nuts is what he's learned and what he can bring to bear. If he wanted to do a different kind of movie, he could.
His foot gets crushed in an accident and the killings begin. Coincidence?
I don't know.
You're a cop, man. Do the math.
Have you considered the killer might be Paul Avery?
Frequently.
He was drinking Coors, getting a load on. Starts talking about hunting people. Like that book. It says how you can put a light at the end of a gun to use as a sight in the dark.
26th of July, 1971. More than 2 years after the murder of Darlene Ferrin and the maiming of Mike Majot, Armstrong dutifully takes notes with another potential lead. Paul Schulz plays Sandy Panzarella, who stares intently at John Hemphill's Donald Chaney. Even before Armstrong is physically compelled to straighten up his posture, Schulz's focus as Sandy is telegraphing the importance of this upcoming message. It's been 8 months following leads, as the Chevron lets us know, digging straight down to get out of a well, as it were.
Like that book. It says how you can put a light at the end of a gun to use as a sight in the dark.
He said that.
Yeah. So I asked him, how would you get away with it? And he said it'd be easy, because there'd be no real motive to the thing. Then he said he'd write letters to the police and call himself Zodiac to mess with them.
He liked messing with people.
You're positive he said Zodiac?
Yeah. I thought it was a stupid name, so I told him. He got up all upset and said, I don't care what you think. I thought about it a long time, and that's the name I'm going to use.
Did you feel like he'd been thinking about it a long time?
He was raw about losing his job at the school. Talked about shooting out the tires of a school bus and picking off the little darlings.
He actually used those words.
That's what made me remember. Afterwards, I told my wife I didn't want to see him again, and I haven't since. Other thing is, Lee's into skin diving. I know he's been up to that lake a bunch of times.
Lake Berryessa. Did you ever go with him?
A couple times. We went fishing by Poudre Creek, near there.
Tell them when you put it together.
About a year ago, in the paper, there was a story about the Zodiac, and it all comes back. I tried to call the local cops.
He blew him off. Thought he was a nut.
And you're sure the conversation you had about Zodiac took place on January 1st, 1968?
It couldn't have been any later. I started a new job in L.A. on January 20th. I had to move.
Armstrong's methods are effortless here. He's looking for motive. He's latching onto specific details. He's building more of a profile on the suspect than they've ever had before, and building the case that he needs to make to get the legal authorization to pursue Arthur Lee Allen. Here's Bill Ryan on Anthony Edwards' naturalism.
Edwards is able to do so much with his eyes in this movie. Have you seen Bay of Angels? Jean Demy's Bay of Angels?
No.
It's a very good movie. It's a great movie. And there's an actor in it, Claude Mann, who for some reason popped into my head when I was watching Edwards this time, because it's the same kind of, in my memory, of complete, like, you know, naturalism in acting and in film, I would say specifically American film, because I think it probably, that would mean a different thing in different countries, naturalism playing differently. But what we might, in America, what we might define as a naturalistic performance is still kind of removed from how people, most people are in real life.
Yes.
It's heightened somewhat, but compared to other kinds of performances, it seems, you know, this is how people are.
Yes.
But Anthony Edwards and Claude Mann in Bay of Angels are the two of the performances that I've seen in my life where I'm like, I think that's how people really are, actually, in my experience. That's how people actually look, and that's how they their facial expressions work when they're communicating something with their face or their eyes, the tone of voice, because it would be considered flat, I think incorrectly, if it's done well, it shouldn't be considered flat by a lot of people, or not, like, I think a lot of people might say, yeah, he's good in it, Anthony Edwards is good, but, you know, who is really great is, and then list, like, Downey, who is great, but that's more of a movie performance.
They're doing completely different. You know, I think one of the things I love about this movie for Fincher, just as a director, is his style, like the dexterity of his style in this movie, taking it to those sort of more horrific and you know, serial killer typified moments of like being in the basement to then really straight-faced, authentic depictions of things. But I think, you know, they talk about Bill Armstrong and they're like, he's the most decent man. That this is what they describe him, the most decent man who ever lived. That's what Toski said. He's just the most decent man.
Yeah.
And to Fincher's credit, he's like, oh, well, that's Anthony Edwards. It's like one of the most decent guys I've ever met. And
it's
And him just being,
he's the guy.
He's so under, and like, probably not for anyone who listens to this podcast, but he's so deeply underappreciated in this movie for what he's doing, because he makes Ruffalo work. He makes Toski work. Everything about their interplay and the balance of their entire weight of the movie is on how they're relating with one another.
So when Anthony Edwards shows up, listening to that commentary, Elroy, who spent a lot of time with homicide detectives, says, "That's my guy."
Yes,
he does. He's like, "That's him. That is a San Francisco, but that's a homicide detective.
A Californian homicide detective.
And I, not that I have spent a lot of time or any time with any homicide detective, but I feel watching it, and it's like, this guy's a homicide detective. It's like the old anecdote about Harrison Ford when he was first starting out and he had some extra part. And I don't know if he would have auditioned for a part like this, or if this was why he didn't get a later part. But anyway, it was basically, the part was a grocery store clerk, and some casting director or somebody said to him after seeing either the audition or the part in the movie, said, when I saw you do that, I didn't think there's a movie star. And Harrison Ford said, I thought you were supposed to say that's a grocery store clerk. Watching Anthony Edwards, I feel that's a homicide detective. I just think he's the man he's playing in that movie.
1st, 1968.
It couldn't have been any later. I started a new job in L.A. on January 20th. I had to move.
This is my problem. This guy...
Arthur Lee Allen?
This guy Lee just lays out his entire evil plan to a fishing buddy on New Year's Day.
I don't know. He's angry. He's been drinking, been thinking about it for a while. I can buy that.
So why didn't Cheney contact us sooner?
I checked. He did. First recorded contact with the police department about Allen was in Pomona, January 10th, 1970. He just got lost in the shuffle.
Did Cheney have anything against Allen? Did Allen screw his wife or anything?
We're going to do a full background check, but I got to tell you, I like this guy.
So let's pull some handwriting samples.
Here's a conversation with Helen O'Hara about the uniquity of the American serial killer, and a little bit of a chat with Matt Zolotzeitz around the disappearance or the evaporation of serial killers in the modern age.
No, I think it's more just the fascination with the nature of this kind of crime. I was thinking as well about Sandman, the Neil Gaiman comic book series.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in that, a storyline in that, where somebody ends up at what's called a serial convention, spelled with a C. But wouldn't you know it, it's a cover for a serial with an S convention, yeah, and a sort of, you know, meeting of serial killers. And it is kind of just a fascinating, it's only a little tiny thing in the books, but it's just a kind of fascinating look into these mentalities and these sort of self-delusions and these weird, otherworldly almost priorities. And I don't know, Neil Gaiman's also said that Europe is spooky because it's old and America is spooky because it's big.
Yes.
And I think there's elements of that in this film as well. Like, it's just, it's such a big job to find one person amid all of this sprawl. You know, if these are completely motiveless crimes, if there's no sort of, you know, James Gum link to the first victim,
yes,
then where do you start? You know, and there's no particular forensic evidence. There's obviously no DNA at the time. There's so little to go on. And they can't, and the jurisdictions can't easily share information on this stuff. I mean, that's what's interesting, I guess, about Manhunter, is that they start this process of kind of trying to tie these things together and try to share information and figure this stuff out. And I think that's why the Zodiac Killer maybe struck the public imagination so much, was that he was the one to put the pieces together and he was the one to say these are all connected, because there's no reason to think that the police would have done without that. Maybe the first two in that it's cut, or maybe even the first three couples, you know, at isolated locations, maybe, but they were all different jurisdictions, so it doesn't even follow there.
And different weapons.
And different weapons. And like, he wasn't very good at killing people. Like, I don't mean to, you know, victim blame here or whatever, but like, you know, he left people alive at the scene. And I mean, it's, when you're watching it in the film as well, when you're watching it, you're like, well, those people are super, super dead immediately. But like, they weren't, they lived long enough to talk. Do you know what? And this is getting a little bit away from Zodiac, but I remember when on New Year's Day, 2020, I thought to myself, you know what, we've actually done really well here, because for the last, I think, 500 years, I think 500 anyway, maybe 600, there has been a major European war in the teens of every century, right? So not just the First World War, but, you know, a century before that was the Napoleonic, century before that, the War of the Spanish Succession, century before that, I forget, but 30-year war maybe? Anyway, but every single beginning of a century in the teens, major European war. And I'm like, dudes, we did it. We got through. No war. And then 2020 happened. So, you know, it does, you're right, it does feel like we're, like things are unsettled again. And so the time for films like Zodiac may once again have come. And what's interesting, like, again, like comparing it to 100 years ago, there are virtually no films from the time about the Spanish flu. There's almost, I think there's a couple of mentions in silent movies that we have, but like, almost nothing. Like, nobody really wrote about it particularly. Nobody really wrote music about it. Nobody really, you know, not to any great degree, at least. I'm sure there are scattered bits and pieces. And I feel like there's an element of that. Like, when that Songbird film was announced that deals with last year, everybody's like, oh, fuck off. Literally, get it away from me. Hide it. I don't want to know.
I don't want to know about it.
I don't know. I have no interest in it whatsoever. We've been here. Let's move on.
You get that, and you get that press screening in by the UK, you just fuck off, and they go, Helen, you're like, no one wants this. Okay.
I mean,
go back to the distributors, bring it out in a year.
I mean, obviously I will watch it because I have to at some point, but like, I'm not relishing the prospect. I feel like there's some things that we deal with by not by saying, okay, that's over, let's move on.
Yes.
And I think there are things that we deal with by actually, you know, facing them. And it's weird, isn't it? Because, you know, this case did inspire a big film of the time.
A huge
very
film.
Closely. Huge film. And Dirty Harry, you know, saved the day and saved the school bus and all was well. But there is a danger that we're a sort of Dirty Harry society, right? There is a danger that we are processing things the wrong way. Like in this country, there's a lot of chat about people not wearing their masks properly, or, you know, standing too close to you in the supermarket, and not enough about the government complete failing on at every possible stage. Blame what we see. We blame the person in the grocery line who's standing a bit too close and whose mask is under their nose or whatever. Instead of thinking about, no, systemically what's wrong and systemically what's happening and overall, what is the big picture here and how can we figure this out? And not just figure this out, but, you know, in the case of this film, like, how can we get evidence? How can we action this? How can we actually make a case against this person? Even if we find the right person, how do we prove it? Which, you know, spoiler, they don't, so.
And, you know, that's another thing, though, going back to something you were saying earlier, this, you know, this emergence of the serial killer. I don't remember who said it, and it's probably more than one person, but there is a theory that the serial killer emerged because essentially in the United States, because the United States had gotten too big to be governable.
Yes.
And by the time we got to the mid-90s, when DNA evidence came in, video surveillance became more common. And then finally we get to the turn of the century when everybody starts carrying around a cell phone that doubles as a tracking device.
Yes.
Now things become more governable. And yeah, we can have that debate of, like, you know, that famous line, those who value security over privacy will have neither.
Yes.
You know, people are often willing, to trade privacy for security, but I certainly personally don't have any regrets about the fact that we've traded a little bit of that anonymity that we used to have in the 70s and 80s and even the 90s for less likelihood of people getting away with crimes,
yeah.
You know, except, I mean, street crimes.
Oh,
no, higher up the ladder.
No, the white collar crime is a booming, Matt. It's booming. Like,
there's
nothing
you can do to them, apparently.
No. Yeah. No, you can't stop that.
We just decided not to prosecute those, but. Handwriting samples.
Hi. Talk to Sherwood. He got the samples. What are you having?
BLT.
So, the check stubs are a wash. There's not enough handwriting. The application's got more, but it doesn't look like Z, so he can't rule them in, but he can't rule them out either.
Well, that's vague.
He needs more samples. Also, our guy is a pervert. When Bell got the application from Bailey Springs, I told him that Alan had been fired for touching kids.
Touching?
Polite euphemism. So what do you want to do?
Make some phone calls.
Are you done with the fries?
Go ahead.
Here's Brianna Ziegler on something that I feel every single time I watch this movie at this precise point. She sums it up just so well. Man, I hope it goes down differently.
It's so measured and it just, I don't know. It's not, and there was another thing about it where it's like, I feel like every time I watch it, I want there to be a different outcome. Like, yes. I was watching it last night and I'm like, all right, Robert Graysmith, he's going to figure it out this time. He's definitely going to get it. Like, I, you know, it's like, I have other movies like that too, where I've seen them so many times, but I still, every time I think, like, all right, this is going to go a little bit differently. Like, and I don't know how to, because it's not like every movie that, I'm not like that with every movie, but this one in particular, I don't know what it is about it where I'm just like, maybe things will go differently this time. And I love revisiting it to give it that opportunity to, like, to try and fix things. Cause I want them so bad. And it's such a, like, and it's also weird to want to revisit again when you know nothing's going to get solved.
Yes.
But at the same time, every time I watch it, and I realize this also at the end, it feels so definite, yes, that it had to have been Arthur Lee Allen. And I, like, and when that text pops up on the screen and when he's wrapping everything up and, like, I feel like I sit through deja vu where I'm like, oh my God, it's definitely Arthur Lee Allen. How did I forget that? But that is, it's this movie where it's like, every time I watch it, it's like, I've restarted the mystery, and I don't know what's gonna happen.
Go ahead.
Did you and Mr. Cheney have a chance to look at the copies of the Zodiac letters we sent you?
Yeah, some of this stuff is pretty creepy.
Yeah, we know.
I mean, creepy like Lee. He misspells words like that. He thinks it's funny.
What about the handwriting?
I don't know. Don't you have experts for that stuff?
Our man at Question Document says it's inconclusive.
Maybe he did it with his other hand.
The letters are a little too neat for someone to have written with the wrong hand.
Not for Lee, right?
What do you mean?
He's ambidextrous. He can write with either hand. Didn't you guys know that?
In everyday life, Alan uses his left hand. Job applications, letters to friends, etc. But he writes the Zodiac letters with his right hand, producing a different handwriting that he can't be linked to.
We gotta see this guy, Chief.
Where is he?
Vallejo. He works at Union Oil in Pinole. His brother's up there, too.
See them both. Make sure you call Mullinax. It is his backyard.
All right, because that works so well for us in Riverside. Cooperation, that's us, at all costs.
In the spirit of cooperation, here's the final word for this episode with Mr. Brendan Hodges.
Well, exactly. And I guess the next point would then be, to what extent is that, you know, a kind of self-deceit? To what extent is that putting all the facts together to make sense because you have to let them make sense? And I'm not saying that against Graysmith's credibility or that I think he's wrong. What I am saying is that, you know, it also in the case of JFK and Libra, DeLillo did the same thing. He looked at every document he possibly could have, and he made what he thought was a very compelling explanation of what went down to the best of his ability. He made it in good faith. He wasn't dramatizing this to be, you know, postmodern and to make all of these high-minded points. No, he genuinely thought his depiction of the JFK assassination was truthful. Was it? Probably not. A bunch of people are like, I don't think it was. And what I'm really driving at is what Zodiac as a movie does, and perhaps Graysmith himself did to some extent, was that even if the facts do go together in a way where you could be satisfied, our instinct to make sense of facts that are only half facts and some are unreliable and some are not and so forth is so powerful that it can crystallize belief under the pressure of our need for resolution. And I think that feeling of that desperation is part of what really gets under your skin when you watch this movie. Feeling that immense weight of, you know, it's like being, you know, in molten lava watching diamonds form, and those diamonds are truth and you're trying to find it. But then there's also equally things that are forming in all of that molten hell that look like real diamonds, and they're not, right? That's the whole thing. And it's hard when you're in that situation to tell the difference. And again, I'm not saying it's not Arthur Lee Allen. I think it probably is. But that's almost besides the point.
Yes.
Because our need for belief and our need for resolution is so powerful, we have to believe it's him, even if it wouldn't be.
That concludes episode 13 of Zodiac Chronicle, Cancer, Part 1. Be sure to subscribe to the show so you're the first to know about all upcoming episodes. If you can't get enough, Unplugged Zodiac sessions will be available exclusively on the 1 Heat Minute Patreon, linked in our show notes. This fortnight is Liz Hanna. Next fortnight is Helen O'Hara. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, and presented by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by Chris the Duff Duffy from Los Espinas. Our companion I Am Not Avery Zodiac Chronicle stickers were done by the talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. And if you really want to see their beauty, the best way to see it is up close. Go and buy yourself a pin. Thank you so much for listening. Next episode is a big one. Until next time.
Goodbye.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save big money
at Menards. If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.